Good evening and welcome to Peace Talk, a production for KTOO Radio's Focus on Community.
One thing God went so far to say, try to imagine. No heaven, no hell, and no God. No king, no country, not even possessions. We all thought he was asking a lie. So we kept on fighting for all of this stuff. But it never turned out to be reason enough to justify losing people we love. Yeah, that's what we did before the end of war. The end of war.
Peace Talk is a monthly program produced by the Juneau Chapter of Veterans for Peace. It's VFP's contribution to our community's ongoing conversation about war and peace and the important issues and questions they raise in our society and around the world. I'm Rich Moniak. We're going to begin tonight's program discussing a lawsuit filed against President Obama that argues that the U.S. war against ISIS is illegal. That will be followed by testimony from Daniel Ellsberg in the case of Lieutenant Erin Watada, who refused orders to deploy to the Iraq War in 2006, because he believed that war was illegal. And last, we'll hear from Eric Kotcher, a lawyer and EMT from Haines, who recently returned from Greece, where he provided medical and some legal aid to refugees of the wars we've been fighting ever since President George W. Bush invaded Iraq in 2003. First, on May 4th, Captain Nathan Michael Smith filed a lawsuit against the President. He's currently serving on active duty in Kuwait in support of the military operations targeting ISIS. He's arguing that the use of military force there is illegal because Congress hasn't authorized it. Marjorie Cohn is co-author of Rules of Engagement, The Politics and Honor of Military Dissent. It is a story of sailors, soldiers, and Marines who have, instead of following orders, turned to the courtroom to make the case that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan violate international law and the U.S. Constitution. Cohn is a legal scholar and former president of the National Lawyers Guild. She's currently a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and is also a member of VFP's advisory board. Her most recent publication is titled Drones and Targeted Killing, in which she edited a collection of expert analyses that explored the legality, morality, and geopolitical considerations of targeted killing. Her blog at marjoriecohn.com is frequently picked up by the Huffington Post. She has been a guest on CBS News, the BBC, MSNBC, CNN, Fox News, NPR, and Pacifica Radio. I spoke with Marjorie last week about Captain Smith's lawsuit. Nathan Michael Smith believes the war we're fighting with ISIS is justified militarily and morally, but he's filed a lawsuit against the president that challenges the legality of the war from a congressional authorization perspective. Bruce Ackerman is one of Captain Smith's lawyers. Last August, in The Atlantic, he published an opinion piece that made the same argument. He cited existing case law which allows soldiers to appeal to the courts if they've been ordered to deploy to a war that they believe is unconstitutional. But in one of the Vietnam War cases he referenced, the court stated that Congress had implied authorization for that war partly because it appropriated funds for the war over a long period of time. Can you discuss the difference between Congress debating authorization for a war versus a debate to appropriate funds for an ongoing war that they actually never have debated?
Yes, Congress appropriating funds is not a tacit authorization of that conflict. I mean, there could be any number of reasons that Congress could authorize funds, including being concerned about our soldiers being in harm's way. But that is not a tacit approval, just like the use of military force in violation of the UN Charter, because it's not being done in self-defense or with the blessing of the Security Council, is not made legal. It's not erased. The violation is not erased just because there is some retroactive action by the Security Council. The War Powers Resolution, which was passed in 1973, to prevent presidents from doing what Nixon did, basically going beyond the limited authorization of the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which in itself was based on a lie. The War Powers Resolution requires the Commander-in-Chief to gain the approval of both houses of Congress within 60 days of introducing forces into conflicts involving imminent hostilities. And if the president fails to get that congressional authorization, then he must end his campaign within 30 days. The conflicts in Libya and Syria have gone on more than 60 days, so they violate the War Powers Resolution. And two federal courts of appeals considered challenges to the legality of the war in Vietnam, although the war ended before the Supreme Court could make that determination. But in terms of Captain Smith's case, both the Nuremberg Principles and the Uniform Code of Military Justice create the duty to obey lawful orders, but they also, by implication, create a duty to disobey unlawful orders, and the order to deploy to an unlawful conflict is an unlawful order. And this is something that I've testified to in military hearings and courts martial, generally during the sentencing portion, and we have had some success with that. Also, in 1802, Chief Justice John Marshall, Supreme Court Chief Justice John Marshall, was confronted with the question of whether a military officer had a duty to disobey unlawful orders from his commander-in-chief, and the Supreme Court said, quote, a commander of a ship of war of the United States, in obeying his instructions from the President of the United States, acts at his peril. If those instructions are not strictly warranted by law, he is answerable in damages to any person injured by their execution. So there is an excellent argument to be made that, in fact, President Obama is unlawfully sending our troops to fight in these conflicts. Now, the Obama administration uses this 2001 and 2002 authorization of the use of military force to justify his war against ISIS. And he actually presented a proposal to Congress a little over a year ago for a new authorization for the use of military force that would specifically authorize force against ISIS and its associated persons or forces. But Congress did not buy it. They didn't agree. Many of the Democrats thought that his proposed Obama's proposal was too broad. Republicans thought it constrained his ability to use ground troops. Obama's proposal didn't contain any geographical limitation. It would authorize the use of military force anywhere in the world. And it specifically said it does not authorize the use of United States Armed Forces in enduring offensive ground combat operations. But it didn't contain any definition of enduring. What does it mean? A month, a year, 3 years, maybe 6 months with a break? And his that provision was riddled with exceptions because there were thousands of U.S. military personnel in Iraq who were exempted from the limitation, and special operations forces, people gathering intelligence, et cetera. So then Obama said, well, Congress, you're not going to give me a new authorization for the use of military force. It doesn't matter because my war against ISIS is legal anyway against these 2001 and 2002 AUMFs, authorization for the use of military force. But if you look at them, the 2001 AUMF authorized the president to use force against those nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks on September 11th or harbored such organizations or persons. But the license of that 2001 AUMF was limited to those connected with the 9/11 attacks. And in fact, when George W. Bush asked Congress for authority to deter and preempt any future acts of terrorism or aggression against the United States, Congress refused. The 2002 AUMF does not apply to ISIS either. It only sanctioned military action against Iraq. It was aimed at weapons of mass destruction, and that authorization has expired. So I think that Captain Smith is correct that this is an illegal use of force, that Obama is sending our soldiers to fight in an illegal conflict. And even if Congress did authorize it, it would be illegal under the UN Charter, which, as I said, only authorizes the use of force in self-defense or when the Security Council agrees. Neither of those things have happened. and would also violate the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which guarantees the right to life. Both the UN Charter and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights are treaties the United States has ratified. And under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, when a treaty, a treaty which is ratified by the United States becomes part of the supreme law of the land, it becomes part of domestic law.
So then, where does Captain Smith fit in comparison to the soldiers you wrote about in your book, Rules of Engagement, with the subtitle of that's The Politics of Honor of Military Descent? He's obeying the order, but he's contested in civilian court, whereas I think most of the soldiers that you discussed were much more actively protesting or dissenting.
Well, yes. As I said, there's a duty to obey a lawful order, a duty to disobey an unlawful order, and an order to deploy to an unlawful conflict is an unlawful order. My testimony in the Pablo Paredes case, in the Matthew Charoux case, for example, my testimony that would have taken place if the judge would have allowed it in the Aaron Wittada case, said that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were unlawful wars because they violated the UN Charter, and an order to deploy to Iraq or Afghanistan would be an unlawful order, and there's a duty to disobey it. So my testimony corroborated the reasonableness of those service members' refusal to go to those conflicts. Also part of my testimony was that there were war crimes being committed by U.S. forces in those countries, torture and other kinds of killing of civilians, and so the order to deploy to a conflict where a person, a service member, might be put in a position of committing war crimes would also be an unlawful order. Now, Captain Smith is contesting the legality of the war against ISIS, but he is continuing to deploy. That's the difference between his case and the cases that I mentioned that are detailed in my book, Rules of Disengagement.
Let's talk about Lieutenant Wittada's case. Like you said, he argued that the war violated the UN Charter and the Geneva Convention, the Nuremberg Principles, and that those treaties are part of U.S. law. So he didn't go. He was court-martialed, but he wasn't allowed to use the illegal war defense, as you just said, that you weren't allowed to testify, or you didn't get the opportunity to testify because the judge didn't allow it. How is that different from Captain Smith's case?
Well, the Wittada case doesn't really have any precedential value. The judge in that court-martial, Judge Head, would not let me testify, for example, about the illegality of the war in support of Lieutenant Wittada. But the judge in the Wittada case rejected a pretrial agreement that acknowledged that Lieutenant Wittada had missed his deployment, Lieutenant Wittada said that was not a guilty plea because he believed the war was illegal, but the judge thought it would be an admission of guilt, and so he couldn't accept the agreement, and so the judge declared a mistrial. The defense objected to the mistrial, but the judge declared it. But that's one court-martial. It doesn't really create any precedent. It's the resolution of one case, and what Captain Smith is doing is trying to get a court, and presumably eventually the Supreme Court, to rule that if Congress does not authorize the conflict specifically in ISIS, then it's an illegal conflict and he has a right to disobey those orders, or at least that order to deploy to that illegal conflict would be an illegal order.
So if nothing else, he's going to force Congress to debate the issue. Would you imagine Congress not giving the president or telling the president he has to pull everything out of Syria?
No, they won't do that. I mean, Congress did debate the issue in 2005 when, as I said, President Obama proposed his new AUMF, and Congress decided not to approve it for different reasons. Democrats thinking it was too broad, Republicans thinking that it would constrain the president's ability to use ground troops against ISIS, even though it's politically disadvantageous for anybody to talk about, from any party, to talk about sending U.S. ground troops in anywhere. There's one other thing that I would like to add, Rich, and that is that in 2013, in May of 2013, Obama gave a speech to the National Defense University in Washington, D.C., where he, and at the same time, the White House issued a fact sheet, which was kind of a summary of a classified presidential policy guidance that had guidelines or requirements before that must be fulfilled before the president could send U.S. troops into military conflicts. And some of those were, for example, there must be a continuing and imminent threat to the American people. And this is not just ground troops, but also, I mean, this is drones, for example. There must be a continuing and imminent threat to the American people. And yet there was no definition of what continuing and imminent meant. And in fact, the drone papers, which were handed over to The Intercept last year by an anonymous whistleblower who was involved in the intelligence establishment, those drone papers showed that the Pentagon and the CIA have a 60-day window to act after the president approves a strike, which is not imminent. There was another requirement in the fact sheet that there must be near certainty there'd be no civilian casualties. But one of the two kinds of drone strikes that Obama carries out is called signature strikes. Sometimes they're called crowd killings, where they don't even target individuals. They only target people who are in an area of suspicious activity, and many civilians get killed. There's been documentation of thousands of civilians that have been killed in the strike. So even under these guidelines, which remain classified, but the fact sheet, which summarizes them, the use of drones and other forms of targeted killing by the Obama administration violates its own regulations, its own guidelines.
Okay, well, that's important to know. I know the drone debate seems to be going nowhere with President Obama, our Nobel Peace Prize winning president, and it's very, very frustrating.
It is. I mean, he's killed over 4,500 people in drone strikes, many more than died on 9/11. And I talk about this in my book, which is an anthology, Drones and Targeted Killing, where not only is it illegal for the reasons that I've outlined, but it's also counterproductive because it creates more enemies for the United States. When people see their loved ones killed by drones, they want to do us harm. And so it doesn't make us safer from terrorism. It makes us more vulnerable to terrorism. And so there are many levels on which these drone strikes and other forms of targeted killing are bad policy, illegal, and also immoral when you're talking about killing large numbers of civilians.
Yes, and almost after 15 years of war, war doesn't make friends either.
Obama is the longest-serving war president now.
I know, that's sad. It's terrible.
For a Nobel Peace Prize winner, it's pretty outrageous.
You're listening to Peace Talk on KTOO News in Juneau. That was legal scholar Marjorie Cohn discussing the lack of congressional authorization for the current U.S. military operations against ISIS. Cohn mentioned the case of Lieutenant Everett Watada. In 2006, he refused orders to deploy to Iraq because he believed the war violated America's constitutional obligation to international treaties we've ratified, and therefore he believed his orders for deployment were illegal. He was court-martialed, but not allowed to use that argument in his defense. In January 2007, I had the privilege to be a member of a citizens panel in Washington, which took testimony from witnesses Lieutenant Watada would have called had he been allowed his illegal war defense. Cohn provided a statement via video to the panel, and Daniel Ellsberg provided testimony in person. Ellsberg is recognized as America's most famous whistleblower by anyone with a serious interest in the history of the Vietnam War. He actually leaked top-secret documents known as the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times and several other newspapers. He turned himself in, expecting to face a life in prison. But his case was thrown out after the judge learned the Nixon administration had ordered illegal wiretapping of Ellsberg and the burglary of his psychiatrist's office. Ellsberg served in the U.S. Marine Corps from 1954 to 1957 and later received a Ph.D. in economics from Harvard. In 1964, on the day of the Gulf of Tonkin incident, he began working in the Pentagon as Special Assistant to the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs. Later, he went to Vietnam as a State Department observer, where he witnessed the movement and activity of U.S. troops throughout the country. He was one of the main contributors to the top-secret study of the war's conduct that was commissioned in 1967. These were the Pentagon Papers, which he would copy and leak to the press in 1971. This is an excerpt from Ellsberg's testimony on the citizens' hearing for Lieutenant Watata.
The greatest decision that a soldier has to face is whether and when to think. Thinking that what you've been asked to do is wrong is indeed essential, a very important part of being a democratic citizen, including a democratic soldier. But that is definitely not enough. What I'm saying is that what Aaron Watata is focusing on are the constitutional and legal issues here that are really almost unique in modern times to this war. It isn't as though we've been raising these issues without effect. We really haven't had such a clear-cut challenge to us as democratic citizens of what to do when our country is engaging in clear-cut aggression. Like Saddam's attack into Kuwait, like the Soviets in Afghanistan, like Hitler into Poland, France, Norway, Belgium, and Holland, and the London Blitz, and Russia, and Japan, into Manchuria, and China, and Malaysia, and Indochina. Clear-cut aggression. Crime against the peace. Well described as the preeminent of war crimes that includes all the other crimes within it. This is not our first war of aggression. A first lieutenant like Aaron Watata, as his president, Polk, gave his order, his unit orders, to do what he clearly recognized was an effort to provoke Mexico into an attacking an American unit in disputed territory so that Polk could announce falsely that Americans had been killed on American territory, which had not happened, and say a state of war exists and dare Congress to do anything about it. And basically, Congress was quite enthusiastic about it, except for one young congressman who had one term in Congress because of his opposition to the Mexican War, and then he was pulled out. And that was Abraham Lincoln, who spent every afternoon making a spot resolution saying, let President Polk tell us the single spot, in fact, where Americans were actually attacked, and so forth. So I'll just very quickly quote the memoirs of Ulysses S. Grant. Grant says, as a first lieutenant who went through the whole Mexican War, I was bitterly opposed to the measure and to this day regard the war which resulted as one of the most unjust ever waged by a stronger against a weaker nation. That's former president, former general of Union armies, Ulysses S. Grant. One of the most unjust ever waged by a stronger against a weaker nation. It was an instance of a republic following the bad example of European monarchies in not considering justice in their desire to acquire additional territory. I have never altogether forgiven myself for going into that war. I do not think there was ever a more wicked war than that waged by the United States on Mexico. I thought so at the time when I was a youngster. Only I had not the moral courage to resign. I lived through such an administration, absolutely, in 1964, where Americans were put in harm's way by Lyndon Johnson in order to provoke an attack on a destroyer which would enable us to justify pre-laid plans for attacking North Vietnam. Exactly as impeachable, exactly as illegal and unconstitutional as anything George Bush has done, but we didn't learn of it. As we, the public, didn't learn of it till years later, after he was out of office. I knew of it, and I didn't tell Congress, and I didn't do anything about it, and I thought it was a bad idea, but the whole bombing campaign, but I did my job. My life changed when some people like Aaron Watata, following the example and the principles set down by our American Henry David Thoreau, who spent only one night in jail because his aunt, to his displeasure, paid his fine, his poll tax. His hope had been to go to court and to raise the issues of the Mexican War as something that could not be participated in, had to be attacked. And I won't, again, I'll just quote a couple statements here. He says, when a country is unjustly overrun and conquered by a foreign army, and especially when ours is the invading army, it is not too early to rebel. He said, obedience to leaders is the wrong choice in that case. He said, the thousands who are in opinion opposed to slavery and to the war, who yet in effect do nothing to put an end to them, they hesitate and they regret, and sometimes they petition, but they do nothing in earnest or with effect. They will wait, well disposed, for others to remedy the evil, that they may no longer have it to regret. At most, they give only a cheap vote. Well, the vote is not irrelevant, but Thoreau did go beyond that in words that Gandhi took very seriously. Cast your whole vote, not a strip of paper merely, but your whole influence. A minority is powerless while it conforms to the majority. It is not even a minority then, but it is irresistible when it clogs by its whole weight. My life was changed by people who cast their whole vote, and did everything they could to change the society, to change what was happening. What I think we see in Aaron Watata is what I saw in Randy Keeler, and what put the idea in my head, the question, what could I do if I didn't try to keep my clearance? If I gave up my job, my career, with all its promises, not just of prestige and interest, which actually didn't matter that much to me, but my inside dope, which did matter a lot to me, my access to information, my ability to influence the people high up. What if I gave that all up? What if I was ready to go to prison like these people, like Aaron Watata, who's going all the way there, nonviolently and truthfully?
So what you just heard is not only a defense for Lieutenant Watata's refusal to participate in what he believes is an illegal war, it's a challenge to us all, one in which Ellsberg synthesized obscure but important American history with a very deep personal sense of humility. For before he became a leaker of top-secret documents, he was like most of us, acquiescing to power to maintain his own personal lifestyle. His rise to become one of America's greatest heroes in the name of peace and justice is instructive for us all. As Ellsberg said soldiers must do at the beginning of that piece, he began to think that America's war in Vietnam was immoral, but for 2 years he was only thinking. It wasn't until he was inspired by others did he consider doing more. In particular, the draft resistors who were prepared to go to prison to help end what they believed was an illegal and unjust war are the ones who gave him the courage to risk spending the rest of his life behind bars by leaking the Pentagon Papers. To really understand his story, you have to read his book Secrets, his memoir that he published in 2002. His heroic walk into a life larger than himself is rooted in the tension between honesty and secrets, between truth and lies. Our journey may not have the potential to reach as sensationally high as his, but we all have the capacity for the kind of self-examination which led to the powerful epiphany that made it imperative for him to risk giving up all the comforts and status of the life he'd known. Now, before we move to the last segment of our show, in following Ellsberg's message to us, let's listen to Silence and Lies by Emma's Revolution.
Came home from school to the world.
This is Peace Talk on KTOO. I'm Rich Moniak. We've been discussing stories of soldiers who go beyond thinking and act on their belief that the wars that our government has sent them to fight violate international and American laws. What does our silence about these wrongful wars give to the world? Eric Kotcher saw one of those tragedies firsthand. He's a lawyer and EMT from Haines, Alaska, who spent 6 months in Greece providing medical support to Syrians and other asylum seekers fleeing wars in their countries, wars we've been fighting on foreign soil for almost 15 years, wars that we might not be fighting if more of us would discover our own moment of truth, like Lieutenant Aaron Watada and Daniel Ellsberg. Eric was in Juneau 2 weeks ago to speak at the Juneau World Affairs Council. Thanks to Joanne Bloom for making that happen. The next day I spoke with him in the studio here at KTOO about his experiences in Greece. The Syrian Civil War began in 2011, and that's just one source of the European migrant crisis. It actually largely went unnoticed in America until the news media began reporting stories of refugees drowning in the Aegean Sea. They were among thousands being smuggled by boat from Turkey to the Greek island of Lesbos. Eric Kotcher spent 6 months providing medical support and some legal aid there. He's here to talk with me about his experience, Thank you for taking the time.
Sure. Happy to be here.
How big is the international effort in Lesbos?
Well, the effort has grown quite significantly in the last year. Starting about a year ago is when international volunteers started showing up because the locals were getting overwhelmed. The locals had been handling rafts with refugees arriving, once a week, maybe a couple of times a week, whatever. But as the numbers continued to increase and as the drownings occurred more on the Greek side, it caused more of a sense of crisis. But it's a huge international effort that's been going on for the last 6-8 months until the refugees stopped arriving about a month ago. And so you have large international organizations like Doctors Without Borders and the United Nations High Commission on Refugees and International Rescue Committee. But the groups I were working with were all independent volunteers or very small NGOs. And they were the only ones really on the northern end of the island where all the refugees were landing. The larger NGOs were down in the main part of Lesbos where the registration locations were that the Greek government ran to register the refugees.
How did you learn about it? I mean, have you done work like this before?
Well, the only time I'd done anything similar to this was working with I went to Haiti a couple of weeks after the earthquake there. But this is such a different kind of crisis, and that was one of the other things that you have to adjust to. As opposed to a natural disaster where there's one single event or a series of events tightly tied in together, where there's a major crisis, there's a lot of emergencies, but then it tends to lessen. And one is you don't have often the infrastructure has been adversely affected, so you don't have infrastructure in those kind of places. But at the same point, as time goes on, there's less and less medical emergencies, for instance, and so forth. Whereas here, you have this constant stream of people, up to 5,000 people a day arriving up on a 6-mile stretch of beach on the northern part of Lesbos. And that made it a very different kind of crisis and an ongoing one. It allowed, in a sense, for people to get organized around it and to understand what was going to be needed. The same things were going to be needed day after day after day. It wasn't going to change. People were going to show up with wet clothing and hypothermic and having come from spending several days or weeks in Turkey in very difficult conditions. So they would need changes of clothes, food, medical exams and stuff like that. And then they would be transported by bus, and the bus system was set up for this and everything else. You could sort of set up systems that would work as long as the circumstances stayed the same.
So were you following the crisis and reached out yourself to engage and help out, or did NGOs get in touch with you?
Yeah, well, I was pretty ignorant about it, other than I was aware that there was a lot of refugees coming out of Syria, but I never really appreciated what that meant in human terms or in individual terms, or what it meant for Greece for that matter, and I'd hear about the drownings and stuff. But I had signed up to be a part of an emergency response team for a group called Remote Area Medical. They contacted a lot of us that had signed up and asked if any of us were interested in being part of an exploratory team that would go to Greece and take a look at what was happening and see how best their organization could fit into providing services. But it was not that well planned. I mean, I ended up meeting two other, a doctor who was already in Athens and a paramedic and a nurse in arriving there. And then the three of us, the paramedic, nurse, and myself, were the ones that went out to explore on the island of Chios and then the island of Lesbos to take a look at what was happening. And the fortunate thing for us is we were not only investigating, but we were actually able to get involved in providing medical care as soon as we got over there, so that we were actually doing 2 to 3 weeks of care at the same time learning how things were working and what needed to be done.
So what were your first impressions of the refugees after you arrived? What condition were they in? I imagine they were all coming by boat. How did they fare that journey across the water?
Many of them, unless it was raining or stormy weather, many of them showed up, in clothing, like just normal street clothing is what they're wearing anyhow. And of course, they were very happy. I mean, what's interesting is we were at the very point, which is probably the high point of their whole experience in this thing. They've left a war-torn country, they've lost relatives, they've been injured, whatever has happened to them. They then had a long process of dealing with smugglers in two different countries or more. and having to do a lot of walking through countrysides and dirt roads and avoiding authorities or dealing with police in various different capacities. And then they finally, the smugglers finally get them down to the beach where the rafts are, and then they get jammed into these rafts. They've heard about the drownings. They're really, a lot of them don't have a lot of experience with water in terms of being able to swim or any kind of boat knowledge. And then suddenly they're sort of pushed out into the ocean, and the person who's trying to operate the boat is just another refugee that's been told that that's their job. And then when they finally arrive on the shoreline, they are ecstatic. They've survived the worst part of the trip, they think, and they're now in Europe. And not only that, but all these volunteers, individual volunteers, have welcomed them, and they've got clothing and food and medical supplies. And there seems to be a system in place that can get on a bus for free to get that'll transport them down to the main town where they have to register. But after that, it actually starts to go downhill because then the conditions continue to get more difficult. And then as time went on, more and more people were not able to get across the border out of Greece. So they now are stuck in Greece. But when I saw them, I was surprised again at how they were clothed, even though this probably shouldn't have surprised me. But you know, a lot of people, they left with just their clothes, but they often took their best clothes with them. Some people were in shoes that were not good for walking, and folks had nice jackets on and stuff like that. But it depends, I guess, on whether they were coming from a middle-class existence or from a much poorer existence. So the Syrians were many more middle-class people that had come, whereas the Afghans and Iraqis had less funds and were poorer and tougher conditions in a war that had been going on a lot longer.
Aside from treating refugees for medical problems, how did you interact with them, and what kind of stories would they share with you?
Well, it's interesting. In the medical thing, we tended to get large groups of people fairly quickly, and there wasn't a lot of time to interact with them much, at least on the island of Lesbos. When they were coming off the rafts, it would just, you'd get 50 people at a time or 100 people at a time if two rafts showed up, and you were struggling with communication and stuff, and they're wanting to move on and so forth. But up at the border where I also worked, there was a population was more stable. We had more time, especially in the late evening.
Just the border with Macedonia.
That's right, yeah, up at the northern border of Greece. And at that border, we were able to talk to the refugees more at certain occasions. If we had a translator or if they happened to be able to speak, one of them would speak English, which was true with certain groups. But where I really got a chance to explore their stories was when I was up there in a legal capacity working with a Greek lawyer, and we were interviewing refugees in a lot of detail to understand their circumstances and to present petitions to the European Court of Human Rights about the failure of the asylum system in Greece to provide them with those rights. And so we had to learn a lot more about the circumstances around which they left, you know, what was going on, where was the bombing occurring, what relatives had been injured or hurt, what had ISIS done to them if they were in that area. And so in those circumstances, I was interviewing people for 30 to 40 minutes through an interpreter, but it was a much different experience in terms of living and feeling, living through and feeling what their experiences had been that moved them away. And then also talking to them about how they were experiencing the camps and the circumstances. And it was interesting. Some people, it's just people that are experiencing the exact same thing in the camp, some people would talk about it as being terrible, and other people would say it's fine. So it's interesting that you bring to that what your own experience is or your own sort of mental attitude as to how you're looking at it.
Well, it's also relative to what you left behind, I suppose.
Exactly.
Yeah. And where you hope to go from there.
Right.
What your hopes
are.
Right. You went there to do medical support, and you wound up doing some legal support. That was by coincidence?
The first three times I went over there, I was doing medical stuff. And since I'm not a doctor, I'm an EMT, I'm working with other professionals. And so I'm in I don't have quite the same initiative or ability to do as much. And then when I was back here, I noticed a lawyer talking about, it's the first time I'd seen this, lawyers were starting to try and get together some pro bono efforts. Because what changed is the refugees in Greece had very little need for a lawyer initially because they were just passing through Greece. And they didn't want to seek asylum in Greece, and they weren't planning to stay there. It's only once the border closed that they were stuck in Greece that suddenly asylum became a much more crucial thing, because if they didn't seek asylum, they were subject to being returned to Turkey. And the asylum services were not able to gear up fast enough to be able to deal with what is now 54,000 people all wanting asylum. So even now, there's still only a couple of hours a week that there are Arabic interpreters available to just take Skype calls, which is what they were requiring people to do to sign up for the asylum interview, which would then be scheduled about 4 months away. So they were getting more help from European countries, workers that were going to help with the asylum process and things like that. But they still have not gotten that geared up. And at the same point, there were a lot of issues around unaccompanied minors and the fact that the Greek government didn't have the resources to help them. And so it was important to highlight that and to bring pressure to bear on Greek governments and European governments to put the proper resources in place so that the thousands of young people below the age of 18 who are not there with a responsible adult can be protected.
Well, you mentioned that the before it became a crisis, the locals were pretty much handling it themselves.
Yes.
Before there was an international aid that came. Is the once that grew out of their capacity, beyond their capacity, has their attitude towards the refugees changed? Are they just overwhelmed, or are they less willing to bring them in?
Well, last week there was a news report on one of the Greek papers about the fact that a poll had been done, and it surprised me greatly because it showed that about two-thirds of the Greek population were not favorably inclined to thinking about the refugees in a positive way. But my experience, especially on Lesbos, the circumstances were different on each island. But on Lesbos, where they have been dealing with refugees for at least 5 years, but not in the numbers, and where they were providing a lot of resources individually on their own, there was much more of a willingness, and there continued to be an important role that the Greeks were playing in terms of providing resources and helping out in all sorts of ways. And so that was, in a lot of ways, a really encouraging thing. I mean, the people of Lesbos that have helped the refugees have been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize because of that work. And they identified, I think, three different kinds of individuals on Lesbos, but local people, to use as the sort of vehicle to highlight that. But and again, up at the border, so there was some mix of both. I mean, I saw hotels up at the border that were, you know, filled with volunteers, and they cut them a lot of slack. They allowed, when there were too many volunteers, they were allowed to camp in the back of the hotel, sleep on the couches in the room. I mean, this hotel had a Syrian family that was there with kids and so forth that they were allowing to sort of hang out in the lobby of the hotel throughout because of that personal feeling. A lot of families have taken people in, and we would hear stories about that. And then we would also see Greeks showing up at the various makeshift camps and large gatherings of refugees, making contributions and bringing food or clothing or whatever. They even had a huge day in Athens where 10,000 Greeks brought supplies, food and clothing and stuff to Victoria Square down there to provide refugees one Sunday. And there was a huge outpouring of folks. So there's that. And then there's also the resistance that you would expect to see within any society for folks that are annoyed at the disruption or afraid of crime and stuff like that. I mean, generally, I think it's a much less violent, more peaceful population than the general populations. Very few crimes occurring, a lot of support among people. Yeah, at times there would be protests by groups of refugees in the camps over the fact that they were not being allowed across the border. And almost always those were peaceful, but at times, you know, there might be some people that were reacting a little inappropriately. And then what's happened is to try and get attention and to try and address their frustration, groups of people have gone to the actual border with Macedonia, to the fence that's there, and tried to pull it down or try to climb over it. And that has engendered a response from the Macedonian border guards of rubber bullets and tear gas and stuff like that.
That's also brought them a lot more international attention as those things happen.
Exactly, and that's why they do it, and that's why it pays off for them, because it's part of what's pushing the European community, I think, to try and address it, and it prevents the people from just forgetting about the fact that there is a problem.
Well, in the European Union, the European countries are split largely on how to address it. Germany is willing to take more than most.
Yeah.
The attitudes have changed about European borders, especially since the Paris attacks in November. But the United States has a big controversy that erupted, especially after the Paris attacks. And what do you think our role is? And is it, are we doing enough? We're a responsible party in the war.
Yeah.
We're one of the many that
Right, and that is contributing to the number of refugees, and as well as coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan, where we have military forces and are creating circumstances under which people have to leave for their own safety. So, well, there's two different ways. So one is financially, we should be providing financial resources to Greece and other countries that are dealing with the refugees so that those conditions can at least meet the minimum in terms of what humanitarian aid would expect. The other issue is I know throughout our country, people I talk to all the time, I'm from Haines. I know there's a group in Haines that would love to welcome a Syrian family or two up there right now. And the problem is that we can't just put them on an airplane and have them show up. And what's frustrating, I think, to many of us is that the process to bring these refugees in is what the U.S. government says is it takes a couple of years. And at the same point, they've limited greatly the numbers. And by doing that and by only allowing those folks to come in through sort of established frameworks, I think it's short-sighted of us to not be welcoming people in. I mean, we have a country of over 300 million in the United States. Greece has had a million refugees passing through it every year. That's one-tenth of the population. If we were doing that, it would be 32 million people passing through, the entire population of Canada passing through the U.S. every year.
So do you plan on going back or otherwise stay involved with this effort?
Definitely. I mean, there's a whole group of us that are trying to create a legal structure and framework for legal volunteers to be involved. It's not quite clear how that can develop at this point, whether we'll be able to be involved with the individual asylum claims of the 54,000 refugees that are currently in Greece. That would probably be the best place for us to do that for those of us that are involved in Greece. There's actually 3 million refugees in Turkey that are looking for help also. But there's a lot of Greek lawyers that are willing to help out. And the question is how to use our lawyers from throughout Europe. So there are several different nonprofits that have developed to do that. The information to the refugees on what their rights are and what's happening to them and stuff is very important itself, even if we can't provide actual representation. And just training them or educating them as to what is important to emphasize in their interviews for asylum. Most of them have come from violent situations, have good reasons not to go back. That's almost always why they left. The men often left suddenly because they were either targeted by ISIS or the Syrian government for military service or otherwise, or were at risk, been imprisoned, whatever. And so when they had an opportunity, they would go immediately, and then the families would follow, which is often what we see now. I mean, 40% of the refugees are children. That's a huge group that we need to be concerned about.
Well, and of course, the best thing we can do is find a way to end the wars.
Yeah, but it's not just wars, of course. The actual largest group of refugees in the world are probably much more coming from famines, water shortages in northern Africa. So I think there's over 60 million displaced persons right now, if not even a higher number. And some of them are still within their country, but they've been forced to move elsewhere within their country, and many of them have had to move to adjoining countries and seeking help. And then there's also wars and conflicts in northern Africa that are driving people away. So in some ways, the Syrian refugee crisis, of which it's produced about 4 million refugees, is a small percentage of what there is out there.
So is there anything else you'd like to share with us?
No, I'm just happy to be able to share, to bring information to people. I think the most important thing that I can do now, at least when I'm here in the country, and one of the things I wanted to do is to go and share my experiences with people, in particular, inviting people to think about the refugees as individual people. Think about you as a family member or your family. If the building next to you had been bombed and destroyed, your home had been broken down, you no longer had running water or electricity, and maybe you, because of your political opinions, you were had been jailed in the past, or you were being threatened, you know, you would eventually choose to leave, and you would hope that where you went was at least open to understanding and hearing what your circumstances were, and did not just assume you were a terrorist when here you yourself were trying to get away from that terror. I mean, that's what everybody's trying to do. They're trying to get away from the violence.
Well, thank you for coming in to talk with me, and I think the work you're doing is admirable, and we'll do our best to help you spread that word and maybe encourage other people to do a little bit more, too.
Well, thanks for what you're doing here. This is at the Veterans for Peace, is that right? Yes, yeah, so that's a good group, and happy to be a part of it. Thanks.
It's time to wrap things up now. This has been Peace Talk, a monthly Veterans for Peace production for KTOO Radio. I'm Rich Moniak. Bill Smith began producing this program sometime in 2006. Remember back then when there was a peace movement during the Iraq War? But after President Obama was elected, many people retreated to quieter places. There is so much he's done that we wouldn't have accepted if McCain had been elected. We have responsibility for the state of our world, and if violence is a plague and we're not doing something to try to change it, then we're a part of the problem. Where was I when we invaded Iraq? I had been an armchair activist and nothing more. What made me become a peace activist and began showing up at demonstrations? The long story is for some other time. That is, if you can corner me alone and want to hear it. For now, I'll just say I had never spoken in public before, let alone expressed my opinion in any newspaper. And I had never imagined I'd be asked to host a radio show. But back in August 2007, I was supposed to be a guest on Phil's show. It was about the temporary missile defense radar system being installed at Lena Point, and I had attended the public meeting there with officials from the Missile Defense Agency. Phil asked me on a Saturday morning before a Monday night show if I'd join him, but that Saturday night he called me and said he had to leave town for an emergency. Would I host the show? Phil has given a lot to our community and a lot to the cause of peace. I had done next to nothing. How could I say no? Next to people like Daniel Ellsberg, Erin Watata, Marjorie Cohn, and Eric Kotcher, those people you heard tonight, I'm still doing very little. But I'm trying, and you can too. Think about coming to a VFP or Juno People for Peace and Justice meeting sometime to see if there is something you can contribute. We need you. Thanks for listening, and have a good night.
The end of war. The end.